This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Are you looking forward to warmer months and getting out in the garden again? Meantime, there are things you can do now to get ready. You can plan and prepare your garden, you can buy your seeds, you can get your tools ready, and you can take classes on gardening and landscaping. Joining us with suggestions on how to get ready for spring and to answer your gardening questions are Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, Peter Huttinger, Director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program and co-overseer of Home Meadow Song Farm, and Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Agent David Kester. Call us with your gardening questions, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. Sarah, David, and Peter, good to see everybody this afternoon.
Thank you for being here.
Let's start off by talking about tools. David, what should people be doing to get their tools ready?
Boy, I'd start by just cleaning them up if you didn't do it this previous fall, and sharpening. It's just amazing what a sharp tool. If you take it out, your hoe, your saws, anything like that, just get it sharpened, oil it a little bit, and you're ready to go. But anything like just you know, having it ready before you need it is key.
Peter, you think is it a better idea to have somebody professional sharpen your tools, or is it something you can do on your own?
I think you can do it your own, really. I mean, the exception might be a chainsaw, but yeah, your hand tools. I mean, the standard metal file, which is called the bastard file, will take care of your hoes and your shovels and things like that. And there's a number of small honing devices that you can get for your pruners and things like that.
Mark, it really helps to have a vise so that you can, you know, keep that tool stable while you're working on it.
And protect your hands.
And protect your hands, exactly. Really, that's a key.
Sarah, what kind of tools should you be? I guess it's a good time to add tools to your collection. What kind of tools would you add?
That's ongoing. But one other thing in addition are pots and containers, and especially in the vegetable garden, baskets. I always sanitize those if you haven't. So no, it's not really a tool, but it's definitely a nice necessity in the vegetable garden. So making sure they're free of debris, leaves, things like that. But as far as like hand tools, I'm always on the look. Yard sales is always nice. Any convention or conference, you know, most of the time they have some tools to look at as well. So,
how do you sanitize the pots, and why do you sanitize them?
So, especially like plastic pots, you can even do it on terracotta. Your pots, a very low dose bleach solution, so usually 1 tablespoon per gallon of water. And then you can use the disinfectant Lysol as well. You just have to be careful when you do bleach on metal. So then you want to use soapy water to get all that off so they don't corrode up.
So what tools do each of you use most often? And what makes the job of working in the garden easier for you?
My favorite is a soil knife by far. And then a scuffle hoe. So those are my two favorite.
A scuffle hoe.
Yeah, so they have different designs.
Remember, I'm not a gardener. So.
Yeah, so my favorite.
At least not much of one.
I call it a diamond hoe. And so it's really nice to be used in small spaces in between rows or in the garden. And, you know, the one that I'm talking in particular has a really long handle. So, you know, someone who is 6'5", or, you know, my height about 5'7", can use it just as easily. But the nice thing about these hoes is that they're sharp on all sides. And so you can push and pull, and it's nice to pull up those weeds and easy on the back. So my favorite is the diamond because it gets really in there. And then the soil knife, it's one side. I like the serrated one that has the serrated edge, and be very careful because it is very sharp. And then there's a point, and then the other side of the blade is dull.
Does it make sense, David, to look for older tools at yard sales? Because sometimes those older tools seem to be better made.
And you know, if you're young and strong, they used to make them much heavier as well. I think, you know, our older farmers, they were used to a little bit heavier equipment. And one of the things that we've done is seen that, you know, we're starting to make them out of different materials, and they're lighter, but they're just as tough and strong. But some of the older ones are, and there's some old things that are out there that we don't have anymore. And I just had a tool class, and people brought some things in that I hadn't seen in years, just different implements and things like that.
Peter, what are you? Bigger on power tools or hand tools for your gardening tools?
Try not to use power equipment. If not, it depends a lot on the size of your garden. But even at the Price Hill Community Garden, which is a half acre, most of that is still done by hand. Occasionally, in early stages of development, we'll use power tillers and walk behind tractors. But one tool, what's called a low wheel cultivator or Haas hoe. There's also Planet Junior makes one, and that's like a small wheel implement that you have hoe attachments and different attachments and cultivator attachments that you can just walk down the aisle with. So if you have a larger space where your aisles are, say, 20 feet to 100 feet, that's a lot faster than using a standard hoe. The other thing I always kind of think about tools is I try and own as few as possible, but one thing is to have some
so
that are.
You're working on the less is more philosophy.
I try, but one thing to consider: if you have fruit trees and you're working with fruit trees, and or doing pruning, anything that needs some fine tuning, like maybe if you keep roses and stuff, it's good to have a separate set of pruners that are in better condition, kept a lot sharper, no nicks, to use for those jobs. Same thing like pruning saws. And then if you're also just out cutting that honeysuckle or doing rougher kind of stuff or cutting things thicker than you probably should have a second backup pair of pruners that you use for those kind of rough and tumble jobs. Or if you're digging out a thing and you want to use a pruner to cut some roots in the hole to be able to get the stump out, you don't want to use your good pruners for that. So I try and segregate my tools a little bit.
David, I didn't ask you what your most essential or most favorite tool is.
Sometimes I go to some of these conferences, and a lot of the tool manufacturing companies have a booth there. And so I always figure I have to, reward myself with one of those. But several years ago, I bought a spading fork, and I have probably used that more than anything because I grow and raise beds, and I can use that. I don't put a tiller in those beds. I just use a little spading fork, turn it over a little bit, and that one, I probably use that more than anything else.
Yeah, so if somebody's just starting to build their collection of gardening tools, what's the first thing you think they should get?
Well, it's just if soil preparation is key, I do think a spading fork would help. I use a hard rake a lot. That's something that will smooth out the beds. And then, of course, Sarah said the scuffle hoe. That's a real important one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the primary tools is, a shovel, a spading fork, a garden rake, and then a garden knife. And, those are some that they're called hari-hari knives. Mm-hmm. But those are interesting because they can be used as a spade. They can be used like any number of things. So it's a tool with many uses.
It's a hairy knife?
Well, it's a Japanese name for it. Okay. I think that's where it originally came from. That's originally a Japanese tool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, but the interesting thing is I like that Dave talked about a spading fork is because I do think that now, even if you do till or turn your soil, but then some people like to do the no-till, that idea of having a spading fork that you pierce this soil and rock it back and forth and open it to get oxygen in there and also to allow other organic matter to sink into our heavy soils, it's a really an underappreciated tool.
What about the things you can get to keep from abusing your knees when you're doing garden work?
That's a great idea. Last summer, we were out, and I was having some problems with my knees, and one of the master gardeners was going to Lowe's, and I asked him to pick me up a set of knee pads, and they did, and I put those on, and I thought I would hate them, but really just in they were Velcro, and I put them on, and just the compression around the knees helped greatly. And then just when I needed to kneel, it just made a huge difference. And I know everybody likes the garden, the kneeling pads, but to me, I've got to move those constantly. And when I have the knee pads directly attached to me, I don't have to worry about that, and I can just kind of keep going.
Yeah, that's why one of the reasons I like the scuffle hoe, because I too have a bad knee, and so I don't have to bend over. And so I'm just literally scuffling the handle on that is long enough So I keep that in mind as well. And also the height of my raised bed. I prefer a taller bed.
We had a master gardener the other night. We were talking about different garden tools. And she said that she borrowed her daughter's volleyball knee pads when she gardened. And she said they were the greatest things in the world. So,
Peter, what do we use, knee pads or?
Well, I don't use knee pads, but I'm not getting any younger. So I have been used, because we use a market garden style. So our beds are usually built on a 30-inch width with an 18-inch pathway. So a lot of times what I'll do for harvesting like bush beans, I'll take a pickle bucket, turn it upside down, and sit on it.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's kind of it. Because my problem with knee pads with me is once I get down there on the ground at, you know, 65, it's a question if I'm going to be getting back up.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. We got a call from Ian. He's looking for evergreen trees that grow well in the shade, and he wants to plant them in the woods by his house. So anybody got any recommendations on that one?
Boy, that's a tough one.
Maybe boxwood. I don't know, like a tree though, a juniper. No, maybe they're not. They're going to be a little
hemlock
sparse.
Is one that but it likes, you know, it needs sun as well. But hemlock's the one, and taxus. Those are pretty shade tolerant. And hemlock, and there's not a lot of choices for evergreen shade, but those hemlock.
Hemlock would be the best option, you think?
For a tree, it would be. And then there's some taxus that if you let them, don't prune them, they'll get really large.
Yeah, there's some beauty. And at Spring Grove Cemetery, there's some giant taxus in there.
Yeah, and that's a good display. The Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden is a good one. And the Arboretum in Lexington and a few other places. And, of course, the Campbell County Extension Office, we're doing some, you know, renovations, and we have a good display of just some of that. But shade is always, you know, viburnum sometimes work well in a shade, but it's not a tree. So, you know, maybe you can, you know, diversify your plant selection. Ornamental grasses, maybe some, depending upon how much shade you actually have. So think about that too. Hemlock's great, but there, of course, is a pest insect that is liking those, the woolly adelgid. Whatever you choose, I just diversify that.
Is there any other special care that hemlocks need, David?
They like an acidic soil, a moist soil. They don't go through drought real well, and just a high organic soil. Just trying to duplicate where they natively are from.
Jerry joins us now at 513-419-7100. Hi, Jerry.
Hello. I have a question about, I have about 50 pounds of wood ash that I've gotten from my wood burning stove. And I was just wondering where I might use that more efficiently. Could it be useful in the garden?
Not without a soil sample. Wood ashes are wonderful sources of potash, except that they are also very, very basic. So you will be raising the pH of your soil when you put those on. If you have an acidic soil to begin with, they could be used. But without knowing that, I would not use them in a garden setting, because you could be really throwing your pH out of whack, and then other nutrients will become available. So get a soil sample before you use those on your garden.
So where's a good place to get a soil
sample? Depending on what county he is in, your county extension office, Hamilton County, in Kentucky, of course, it's Boone, Kenton, and Campbell, and just any of the – you can look up your county extension office online, and they'll tell you exactly the procedure for taking it.
And you can incorporate at low dose in a compost pile if you have that. But as David mentioned, caution of that. And it's also dependent upon what you're going to be adding your compost pile to, what type of plant material. So you can still get your compost pile tested as well to know the pH before you add that. And depending if you're putting in an azalea bed or your blueberries, or you're just putting around ornamentals or your vegetables. So because those nutrient levels are different depending upon your plant selection.
And Hamilton County Soil and Water Conservation District has some really great reference material on this on their website, but they also have a subsidized program where you can get a full spectrum test of your garden done there. I think it's either for $10 or $12. But, you know, one thing about testing for pH, there are like very inexpensive pH meters that you can buy. So, I think you can get them for as little as $10. So it's actually something that's a lot easier to test for. You don't necessarily have to mail things off, and it's actually cheaper just to get a meter.
We had a question coming about willow trees. Should you plant them in their yard, or is it true that their roots can cause damage by getting into water pipes? Any thoughts on willow trees, David?
They are aggressive, and they do. Willows are probably one of the trees that really does seek moisture more so than – they are all after moisture. And no matter what the tree is, it's going to seek – if it becomes deficient, those roots are going to go where there's moisture. And but willows are one of the more aggressive ones for that.
Well, but you also want to take into consideration if you have a wet area of your yard and you want to help dry it up. I know a lot of people will use willow in that context. If they have a low area, because it naturally absorbs so much water. So, it can be both a problem or an asset. So you just have to kind of do a baseline study of your property and figure out if it makes sense. But you definitely don't want to put in, if you have a septic field for a septic tank, you definitely don't want to, stick it right there.
And that's a good point is, if you're thinking about planting a tree, just know the correct plant for the correct site. So a lot of people like willows, but if you're going to put it near your foundation, might not be the best idea. So definitely do your homework. Reach out to Extension. We have some resources. There are other resources available. Just do a little bit of homework before you get that plant.
Now, trees will always end up being much larger than you anticipate.
513-419-7100 to join us. Let's talk to Barry. Hi, Barry.
Hi, this is Barry.
Yeah, go right ahead, Barry.
I'm sorry. I bought a device called a hula hoe about 30 years ago, and I think it's what you were talking about. The best tool I ever bought for weeding, I still use it today. Mm-hmm. And my question is, past couple of years, we've done broadleaf, like zucchini and squash plants. We get a white, milky substance on those leaves that tends to kill the plants. Do you have any thoughts on what that might be and how to deal with it?
A milky substance, I am not sure.
Mildew.
That's more of a fuzzy.
Yeah. Powdery mildew.
Mildew. Okay. So there are organic and synthetic pesticides that you can do, also seed selection. So there are varieties that are resistant. That doesn't mean you will never see it. It's just built some resistance. So make sure you select the correct seed, and also, if possible, practice crop rotation and proper sanitation. So at the end of the season, clean all that foliage up, because in fact, those overwintering spores stay on the foliage. So if you leave one little foliage there and then you plant a desirable plant in that spot, and those spores will be activated once environmental conditions allow and that rain. And so just keep those little points in mind.
One of the things too that I do with squash, because that disease will come in on the older foliage, and so I will plant three successive crops in succession during the season, and your younger foliage on those plants doesn't seem to pick it up quite a bit. And if you can isolate those plantings, start one maybe 3 weeks after the first planting, and then 3 weeks after that, you will be rewarded with squash all season long. And those plants, and then as soon as you start to see it and the yield declines on those, get them out of the garden. You can go ahead and mulch those, put them in the compost pile, the old plants, and you'll have another crop coming right on.
I think something else that people kind of forget, we have heavy soils here, so often we can have problems with drainage. So you want to really plant as many plants as you want. But I've really found that when you give more space, particularly whether squash and tomatoes are like this also, anything that might have problems with fungal issues, they need air and light. So don't overcrowd the plants. And if you can also be sure with the squash in particular to plant them on mounds, and that'll also give a little bit of natural drainage and a little height off the soil, get it a little bit out of the fungal zone. So that's another thing to consider. And I've just found time and time again, when you give a plant more space, you have a healthier space, and you actually end up getting more fruit or vegetables than you would if you had more plants.
513-419-7100. Let's talk to Barb. Hi, Barb.
Hi. I have been longing for years to have a magnolia tree, like the southern magnolia, that chestnut on the underside of the leaf and shiny green on the top. So I'm wondering if this site that has just opened up might possibly be appropriate. The thing is, there was a huge tree with a huge diameter there that we had taken out. They ground the stump, but it's not like they ground it down, you know, a foot and a half down. I mean, it's kind of still there. I can raise the soil level somewhat. We have extremely well-drained soil. I'm just not sure what the root system on them is like if it would kind of spread out horizontally or if it's going to really want to use that deep root.
Barb, it used to be when we'd get that question, we'd just tell people if they really wanted a southern magnolia to move to Georgia. But we have now gotten to the point where we've got some magnolias that do well here, although this winter could be a little bit of a correction for that. I think we're going to see some damage on some of those southern magnolias. But I don't think you have an issue replanting where that one tree was. Just work up that ground and make sure it's well prepared. And we've got all the nurseries are now carrying some of these magnolias, the Bracken's Brown Beauty and several others that are now pretty tolerant of our winter conditions. But it is a plant that you're on the borderline with, and there's some gorgeous ones around. But I would think that with the temperatures that we've had, we're probably going to see some damage on those.
With the magnolia, is there an issue with being too alkaline, being too acidic?
They like a slightly acidic soil, and that should be okay where she's got it.
Another thing, this kind of goes backward. I mentioned Spring Grove Cemetery and Arboretum. You know, you can stop in at the office there. They have like a map, and it's like shows you where all the different varieties of trees are. I think it's a really good idea if you're planting on making an investment in a big tree, or even if it's a small sapling that'll grow into a big tree, to go over there and actually see what these things look like when they're mature height. And also you get an idea of how, you know, healthy it looks in this climate.
513-419-7100. Elizabeth joins us. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi. I have a question about a peony bush. We have one that we always plant in this location by our shed, and every year it dies. So I was wondering if you guys had suggestions about where we could replant it or what's happening.
Well, they too get powdery mildew, like, very badly. So if it's a young tree and it's not airing out, I've had great success, though. They die all the way back to ground level, and then we prune off the remaining leaves because we try to prevent further spread of the powdery mildew. If it's not getting enough sunlight, if it's not airing out, that can reduce bloom. Aphids really like them, and ants. So maybe, I don't know. I'm kind of stumped.
There may just be something about that site. I don't, without seeing
too much water.
It, yeah, I mean, it could be too much water. There may be some contamination or some reason that you're having issues with that. And definitely, I would try another site and just get read up about peonies. They're full sun to partial shade. They do well in, and of course, all of them, we say, well-drained soil, high in organic matter.
Jane joins us at 513-419-7100. Good afternoon, Jane.
Hi. I just wanted to call to encourage anyone with a neighborhood community garden to please join. In my own specific case, I live in an apartment, and my closest supermarket is approximately 4 miles away. But there is a neighborhood community garden that I joined. It's at a nominal cost, And I've noticed that what I spend on, say, purchasing my own vegetables and some fruits in 1 to 2 weeks actually grows enough fruits and vegetables for an entire season, say from March to early November. And I, you know, it's unfortunate that in my own daily walks that I've noticed gardens in adjacent neighborhoods that are just sitting, not being used, actually going to waste. So, again, I would just like to encourage anyone, especially if you're an apartment dweller like I am, to please join your neighborhood community garden and to please use it, because they really are an asset to any neighborhood, and they just shouldn't go to waste.
Thank you. Will you tell us what community garden you're involved with?
Well, I actually live in Dayton.
Okay.
And my own community garden is the Grafton Hill Community Garden.
Neat.
And I've lived in this area about 2.5 years now, but I never noticed it until they put the signs up until about 7 months ago. I became a volunteer, started growing my own vegetables. I now rent 2 beds. The cost for me to join as an apartment dweller is $10 for the season. I have 2 beds, one 12-foot bed at $25, another 20-foot bed at $35, and I grow more than enough fruits and vegetables. I actually end up giving some away.
That's super. You're the kind of advocate we need. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, it sounds pretty like that's a good use of her money, too.
Oh, yeah. And I think that I'm really glad that one thing she brought up is that I've worked with a couple different nonprofits that do community gardens, and often people want to start new community gardens, but there's a lot of them that just need to be adopted and or need additional members. So her suggestion, I think, is really excellent. And I think that if you live in Cincinnati, you want to look for locations for community gardens, you can go to the turnerfarm.org website, or you can go to the civicgardencenter.org website. And both those websites can direct you to different gardens where you can participate in. Which also kind of brings to mind is that on February 20th, Turner Farm, we're starting our community garden classes, and they'll be at Price Hill, and they'll be taking place at the recreation center there. They're free. And then part of those classes, there's 6 classes that are in the classroom, and then there are there's 4 classes in the classroom and 2 classes that are actually in the community garden, where you get hands-on experience with Joshua Jones, our garden manager there in Price Hill, and those classes are free.
And the Civic Garden Center has a series as well going on, and that is really an excellent program.
Yeah, it's a good time of year planning out your garden to get some education.
Absolutely.
And,
Anything
going on in Campbell County, Sarah?
Oh, yeah. We have all of our classes. They've been actually starting right after the holiday when we returned back to work. And for those folks in Campbell County, the What's Happening should be circulating to your doorstep in the next day or two. So open that up, schedule events for your family. Most of our classes are free. But for horticulture, I mean, we have a rain barrel class coming up. We have a fruit pruning workshop, various workshops on, the ornamental garden, and a few classes about, vegetable gardening. And we have youth gardening programs as well. So check it out. Most of them are during the day, maybe some at lunch, and then there are a few in the evening.
Yeah, and in terms of fruit pruning, Dave is going to be teaching some classes at the Hayfield Orchard here in the Cincinnati area, and that's on February 24th, and then a grafting class on March 31st. So that's a really great hands-on. And that Hayfield's orchard's very nice because they have trees that are young whips to mature trees, dwarf trees, semi-dwarf, standard trees. So you get a really wide spectrum different options you have for growing fruit trees in this region.
Yeah, and speaking of fruit pruning, February 23rd, it's a Friday. In Campbell County, we have a fruit pruning workshop. The UK specialist, Dr. John Strang, will be coming up. And we're actually using the orchard over at the Giving Fields in Melbourne, Kentucky. So if you're interested in that class is free. Call the Campbell County Extension Office to register.
We had an email from Hannah, who moved into a new home, and she is a new gardener. And her question is, when is a good time to get rid of old plants and shrubs and planting new or moving current shrubs to other parts of the yard?
I probably in the next month or so. I mean, I don't do it when it's obviously sloppy out there. But really, within March, April, May, those are all good months. I'd try to get the moving of the plants done in March or the end of March and April, and then replanting. Your nurseries will be well stocked coming up in April, May, and it'll be a great time to make some new selections and replace some things. But you're coming right up on a really good time of year to be doing all that.
You know, when you're redoing a landscape, think about your soil, because you might have some soil loss when you dig up plants. So think about maybe getting a delivery of some really good compost. You know, just because you might buy some soil that is fairly inexpensive, look at the quality of the soil. Just be mindful of that. But that's always adding organic matter into the garden will be beneficial.
We too, when you're planting shrubs and trees, slightly mound the ground because it will naturally settle, and then you can end up having your tree. And I've seen this as a problem with grafted fruit trees often, is that they'll settle in and then the soil builds up through mulching, and the next thing you know, you're at that graft mark, and which can create problems. Mm-hmm. So always have a gentle mound, whether it be ornamental shrubs or fruit trees or whatever, I think is going to be really beneficial.
And let's talk to Bennett. Hi, Bennett.
Hi. I had built a raised bed just about 2 years ago with leftover wood I found, and it's already rotted and falling apart. So I wanted to know if you had any suggestions about making something more durable, including using a non-wood product.
There's a number of different options. I mean, the traditional option is cedar. You'll get a lot of bang for your buck out of that. It is more expensive, but in the long term, it'll last. And also, you know, you can use, people are using the pressure-treated pine, but pressure-treated pine is actually not really rated to hit the ground anyway. It's supposed to be on concrete flats and stuff when used for porches. The new versions of this, they feel are chemically inert and aren't toxic, but not everybody feels comfortable with that. So you just need to do some research and make a personal decision. Now, in terms of the synthetics, you know, there is the material, there's a couple different brand names I'm not supposed to say on the air, but they're basically plastic composite lumber, those will work. But the trick with those is that generally they come in, they're 3/4 inch by, I think, around 5 inches, so it's not a very high bed, so you have to stack them. But they don't have much tensile strength. So, mm-hmm. for instance, if you're using in decking, I think you have to put them on studs on 12-inch centers instead of 16-inch because of they don't have the tensile strength of a long-grain piece of wood. So, if
they've got a lot of give in them.
They bow.
Yeah. So if you're going to use them for a garden bed, you need to, on the outside of them, have some sort of staking system to keep them from bowing out. Now, one thing I always kind of was – I haven't tried this yet. I always wondered – why not just have a bowed bed and just sort of arc them in the same way so you can have like a semicircle? I need to test that theory. But those products will, I mean, I've seen people use them. I've seen them, some that are, you know, they do fade some, but I've seen some that were like 8 years old that were perfectly intact. But where people got in trouble was that the staking system on the side, you need to make sure. So if you're using those types of bed, I wouldn't do a 10 or 12 foot long one. I'd keep to 8 foot lengths and do multiple beds. And I would go with a 4 foot width and no longer than a 4 foot width. But that's in general, when you build a raised bed, you should never have a bed over 4 feet wide because your standard arm reach is around 24 inches for comfort. So I've seen people do 8 by 8 foot beds and then they are putting boards down the center to walk in.
Interior.
Yeah, so that's something that 4 by 8. Turner Farm will be doing a raised bed building class sometime in March. You go to our website and check it out. And I know the Civic Garden Center, Greg Potter, does some classes like that also. So, but that's it. But the composite lumber is a really good long-term solution as long as it's braced.
Mark, I built one a few years ago with concrete blocks. And, of course, they have the holes in them. Mm-hmm. And so I stacked them too high and staggered them. And before I put the second layer on, I filled it with some soil inside those holes. And then I got to the second layer, so I was up about 12 inches or so, and I filled that with, and then I put herbs in the holes, and then, of course, backfilled it with good soil in the bed. And it was kind of a really neat—
Did it hold up pretty well for you, David?
Oh, the concrete blocks, I'll have that bed there forever. But they're heavy. They're no fun to work with. But and honestly, I don't think they look as good in the landscape as the wood material. But it's a very sturdy bed that you can, even if you don't put soil in it, you can sit on the edge of it and tend the bed within.
Yeah, I also was going to say any type of rock, hardscape material. One material that I would strongly discourage from using are old tires. I have seen that in some community gardens and for toxicity purposes. So any leaching of that could be absorbed, could be touched. So I strongly discourage people mound them up, paint them, things like that. And I have a personal belief that toxicity of that is still leaching out. So I just, I'll give them to a tire man. Yeah, I'm tired of talking about it.
Yeah. Well, to add on to what Dave suggested with the block too, there are the retaining wall blocks. Mm-hmm. And I've seen people, if you want something mm-hmm. more decorative and they have like a capstone mm-hmm. on them, those are very effective. But if people email me at peter@turnerfarm.org, I have a class handout that we do from the bed building class, and it discusses different materials and measurements and things like that. So if people email me, I'd be more than happy to share that PDF document with them.
Email address one more time there, Peter.
Oh, peter@turnerfarm.org.
Gina called, and she has three apple trees. She lost one to deer, and the other one's produced, but there's lots of wormholes. So her question is, how can she reduce the worms and protect from deers? Now, her mother suggested putting white stones down around the tree to prevent the worms. So she's wondering if that will work. So any advice on heading off the worms and the deer at the same time?
The deer are you're looking at fencing for that. But the worms are not going to be deterred by any kind of white things around the base of the tree. They're going to come in, fly in a moth or depending on what the insect is, they'll be flying in. So you really are going to have to do an insecticide. But the first thing, I'd really like to identify the insects so that we could really then find the most economical as well as the most environmental way to control those. And, fruit trees and roses, I always say, are two of the toughest things to grow organically and or even with minimal pesticide usage. So finding out what it is and helping you identify those, we can probably help you with an organic insecticide that'll take care of it.
Yeah, and also, Dave, maybe you could mention the use of the preventative, a dormant oil spray. And
right.
Yeah, that's kind of
coming up here, we're really end of February. Well, when we get into March, before your fruit trees leaf out, you'll want to get a good dormant oil spray on them, and that's an organic and completely safe spray, but you spray it on differently. You're putting it on bark and twigs and foliage, there will be no foliage, so you put it on to the point of drip. You want to actually see that material dripping down the trunk and completely covering the tree. And it will smother any of the overwintering insects on that. And believe it or not, there's a lot of insect eggs that are overwintering into your trees. And so putting that on is a great way to start your spray program.
Is it easy to find dormant oil
spray? Yes, very easy to find. You'll find that at any of the discount stores as well as your hardware stores and garden centers will carry dormant oil.
And what you want to do when you look at those sprays, and some of them combine different fungicides and stuff in them too, but get one that says the OMRI written on it, mm-hmm. OMRI, that's an organic certification. But some are petroleum-based oils, but many now are vegetable oil-based. So you want to do the vegetable oil base is important. But also University of Kentucky Extension and Ohio State University Extension both have excellent bulletins that you can access online or order from them on taking care of small fruit and fruit trees, and they're geared towards homeowners. They're really fantastic. And I really strongly suggest taking care of that free resource or take advantage of that free resource.
Thank you, Peter.
Yes.
Let's get to Blake's phone call. Hi, Blake. Oh, we lost Blake there. Let's go to John. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Okay. I was just following up about the southern magnolias, and we planted a couple of years ago some cherry laurel, and of course we've had some dieback from that, and I wondered what the experience is with the panel about cherry laurel. Does it usually just die out? Is it better to replace it with something else? Would the hemlock be more suitable? We have sort of a hedge of this, and it's been quite pretty, but now not so pretty with much dieback, but we're not so sure whether it's completely dead or not.
You know, I'd love to hear from some nursery people regarding cherry laurel. Experience with it has been similar to yours, is that I had some real issues with it over years of dying out, and yet I have seen some gorgeous plantings of cherry laurel in neighborhoods, and actually saw one used as a hedge. Don Soper, a former master gardener, had it in his property, and it was just beautiful. But I've had that experience, and honestly, I'm not up on it enough, and I think I would talk to some of the nurserymen regarding cherry laurel.
Yeah, I knew at one time there was some root rot issues going on. I saw some dieback in the middle, and I traced it all the way back. Didn't see any insect or mechanical injury or things like that. And when we dug up the plant, the roots were actually rotting out. So unfortunately you have to sacrifice a plant because you have to dig it completely up and actually see. And in Campbell County and the Northern Kentucky counties, we can take a sample, the root sample, and some foliage samples, some stem samples, and actually send it to the University of Kentucky Pathology Lab for further diagnostics to see that, because that's of course an investment. And if you have a hedgerow or large planting, you know, you want to understand and identify the issue going on so you don't replant a plant of that same, you know, species. So I would be curious to know what the underlying issue is.
Blake's question, we'd lost him earlier. He was calling to ask about the difference between crabgrass and Johnson grass.
There's a big difference, except they're both really invasive. Johnson grass is if you have Johnson grass, you'll probably, I mean, they're, the size difference in the two of them is significant. Johnson grass is a real tall, has a probably can be 5-6 foot in height. Crabgrass was maybe 12-18 inches, I think, and quite a size difference. But in both of them, the Johnson grass will overwinter with the root system. And it will, of course, also go to seed, which are very viable. And crabgrass is only going to spread for you by seed. And so right now, believe it or not, all the crabgrass is dead. But the only thing that's surviving in your lawn is the seed. And it will be germinating here in the next, 2-3 months. And that's when you need, if you're going to try to prevent it, a crabgrass preventative.
Let's talk to Betsy. Hi, Betsy.
Hi. My question is about, I never got around to pruning back my rose bush and butterfly bushes. Can I do it now?
Well, welcome to the club, because I never did either. So roses, David, you might want to answer on that one, because it's going to be dependent, I'm assuming, upon which one.
Yeah, I'd leave them alone now, and when you get closer to spring, you'll see it start to leaf out, and you can cut back to live wood. Or quite honestly, this could have been a tough winter on them, mm-hmm. so they may die back pretty far. Just wait until they start to leaf out and then cut back to that to where they're starting to grow.
And then your butterfly bush, I would wait to prune that, because they You want to prune after they flower. And if it's a newer variety, they could bloom continuously. So they can actually bloom on new and old wood. So if you're not sure which variety you have, I would wait after it blooms and then prune
it. Okay, because it kind of got pretty big. But it was beautiful in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, I'll wait on that. The other question is, I have some ornamental grasses that have just grown too thick and full. How do I cut those back?
Well, it's easy to tie them up first. Strongly recommend that. Tie them up in a bundle. I love to wait till, late February because I love the way that they look naturally and it creates habitat for our wildlife. And then, I just cut them back with some shears. So any other suggestions?
They make sure you sharpen your shears before you go at them because that will really help you. Weed eaters are pretty effective. You have to kind of go at them slow and just take a little bit at a time. But some of the weed eaters are very effective.
When we do ours, I kind of bunch them up or tie them up depending on the size of them and try and make a nice even cut on the bottom. I guess I like it to look clean. But then I just take the dead straw and just lay it around the plant sequential circles and use that as a mulch for around the actual grasses. So you don't you can also – I've never really had much problem with them seed spreading in the compost, but I think in place is very convenient, and it really looks quite nice.
So if she wants to manage them, she needs to cut into some of them and dig some of them up.
It is a good time coming up to divide them as well, and that's you're going to need to really, again, sharpen that spade before you go at them, and that'll help you. But that straw material that you get out of there, make sure you don't throw that away. That is really some valuable stuff. I love to put it in between my vegetable beds in the garden.
Quick answer, one more question here. Quick answer on this one. Britt called, their dog uses part of the flower bed as its bathroom. So should he worry about the pH level in the soil and the plants there?
In flowers, no. I mean, you should be fine with in a flower bed. If it was vegetables, I'd be concerned. But if it's just a flower bed, you should be fine.
Yeah, there's pathogens and different things with cats and dogs. You don't want them going in your vegetable garden.
Not a good idea, but it's not going to affect the flowers.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, don't compost or poop.
Yep.
Yeah. Sarah, David, and Peter, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was fun today.
Thanks. Campbell County Extension Office Horticulture Agent Sarah Stoles, Peter Huttinger, Director of the Turner Farm Community Garden Program and co-overseer of Home Meadow Song Farm, and Boone County Cooperative Extension Horticulture Agent David Kester.